Our Hebrew Bible reading is from the book of Isaiah, chapter 51, verses 7 and 8. Listen to me, you who know righteousness, you people who have my teaching in your hearts. Do not fear the reproach of others, and do not be dismayed when they revile you. For the moth will eat them up like a garment, and the worm will eat them like wool. But my deliverance will be forever, and my salvation to all generations.
Our epistle reading this morning, which is just a fancy word for letter from the New Testament, is from Galatians chapter 1, verses 13 through 17, and then chapter 2, verses 11 through 14 and 18. This is Paul writing to the church at Galatia. You have heard, no doubt, of my earlier life in Judaism. I was violently persecuting the Church of God and was trying to destroy it. I advanced in Judaism beyond many among my people of the same age, for I was far more zealous for the traditions of my ancestors. But when God, who had set me apart before I was born and called me through God's grace, was pleased to reveal God's Son to me so that I might proclaim him among the Gentiles, I did not confer with any human being, nor did I go up to Jerusalem to those who were already apostles before me, but I went away at once into Arabia, and afterwards I returned to Damascus. But when Cephas, known as Peter, came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood self-condemned. For until certain people came from James, Peter used to eat with the Gentiles. But after the people from James came, Peter drew back and kept himself separate for fear of the circumcision faction. And the other Jews joined him in this hypocrisy, so that even Barnabas, the faithful apostle, was led astray by their hypocrisy. But when I saw that they were not acting consistently with the truth of the gospel, I said to Peter before them all, "If you, though a Jew, live like a Gentile and not according to the laws of the Jewish people, then how can you compel the Gentiles to live like Jews? For if I build up again the very things that I once tore down, then I demonstrate that I am a transgressor." Will you pray with me? May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O God, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. So today we are hanging out with Paul, the man who, as you may remember from a few weeks ago, held people's coats while they stoned Stephen. Coat check guy for a stoning of an apostle is not something that you want on your resume, right? But yes, we're talking about that Paul. Well, as he explains in the first part of this morning's scripture, Jesus knocked him off his high horse, literally, and he had a major change of heart. He started preaching and teaching about Christ to the Gentiles, and that is the non-Jewish pagan peoples. And he generally applied his former zealousness for observing the law to zealousness for believing in Jesus. As we discussed at Bible study on Wednesday night, Paul can be a lot to stomach. Subtlety and nuance are not his strong suit. And with Paul, it's never both and, it's always either or with no gray area about it. Paul manages to speak extensively about humility while somehow never being wrong, and while faithfully putting himself and his own conclusions at the center of every argument that he lays out. And his main concern isn't really Jesus's profound teachings or life-changing healings or radical love. His main concern is elaborating the finer theological points of how Christ's death and resurrection puts us on God's good side. It's a message he hammers home over and over again in hard-to-decipher rhetoric that never really addresses why it might be problematic to think of God as a vengeful deity requiring human sacrifice in order not to condemn us all to hell. All the same, though, Paul has his good points. Without the extensive church planting and church nourishing that he did, we likely wouldn't have the Western church that gave birth to our tradition. Paul is where we get passages like love is patient, love is kind, where we get the fruits of the Spirit being things like gentleness and patience, peace and self-control. He makes a moving, compassionate argument for moderating our behavior so it doesn't become a problem for fellow believers who struggle with something that we don't. And in today's passage, he gives us a powerful example of standing up for what's right in the face of pressure, even the well-meaning kind, pressure to change one's tune. As we talked about last week, one of the major controversies of the very early church was how and even whether to bring into the church these Gentiles, these pagan folks or formerly pagan folks, even after it became clear that God intended for Gentiles to belong in the church. One faction believed that they were welcome as is, while the other advocated for them to follow the law and be circumcised so that they could enter into full covenant with God as they understood it. Now, Peter has been at the center of this drama. Not only had he, as one of Jesus's closest followers, had a front row seat to the way that Jesus taught and healed Samaritans and centurions and other outsiders, but later, after Jesus's death and resurrection, God specifically tells Peter in a vision to quit treating as other those whom God had marked as welcome. Peter even baptized the first Gentile, a Roman centurion, into the church. So it's no surprise to find that Peter has been sharing meals with newly converted Gentile Christians, living into this radical gospel way of loving and belonging. But not everyone was convinced. His habit of sharing his dinners with Gentile converts was seen by some Jewish Christians, those who came from James, as outside the bounds of Torah because of both dietary laws and prohibitions against fraternizing with people who had very recently been idol worshipers. So if the newcomers were going to follow the rules laid out in the first five books of the Torah, including keeping kosher and being circumcised, then of course they'd be welcome. But let's do this thing properly, this faction seems to say. So we come to the incident Paul talks about in today's passage. Some Jewish Christians sent by another apostle, James, show up and they pressure Peter to stop eating with the Gentiles. After their visit, the text says Peter drew back and kept himself separate for fear of the circumcision faction, and all the other Jewish Christians followed suit. Can you imagine how that must have felt to the newly converted Gentiles who were just beginning to understand this gospel that, so it appeared, welcomed all in liberating love? Can you imagine what it must have felt like for them to suddenly be reduced to second-class citizens, to be ostracized by the, quote, real believers who would no longer associate with them? It must have been a crushing blow, one that threatened to disillusion them about this whole Jesus person whose message they so desperately wanted to believe. So Paul rightly calls Peter out for bending to the pressure of the circumcision faction, as they call it. How could you live as though you were one with these new converts, Paul demands, and then cast them aside while holding them to a standard that you don't even follow anymore? It's the antithesis of the gospel, he fumes, and he's right. I have some empathy for Peter here, though. As we talked about with our young people, who among us hasn't had a revelation, maybe not one where God speaks audibly to us, but a realization of the right thing to do in a given circumstance, the just thing to do, but then felt or maybe even given into pressure to back off when our position threatens the comfort or power of someone else? I know I have. It can seem clear on paper what the right course is, but often in real life, the someone else trying to lead us astray, so to speak, is not a bad guy. James, the apostle who sent the circumcision faction to visit Peter and Paul, certainly wasn't a bad guy. Often it's someone we love and trust who wants the best for us or the best for our community, but who lets that desire be thwarted by their own fears or insecurities. I think of a friend who has, over the last two decades, increasingly despaired in their corporate career and who longs desperately to do something more life-giving with their time, yet whose parents continue to pull them back from the brink with well-meaning concern about their financial security. Or I think of another friend who has spoken boldly and bravely about the abuse in their family, only to be gaslit, to be ignored by every single relative they have. Not necessarily because those relatives are terrible people, but because they can't admit that their own behavior enabled or contributed to the abuse. And they can't face the incredible disruption that will have to take place in order to confront the abuse and heal from it. Or how about people of various identities in our country who are treated as second-class citizens, folks because of their sexual orientation or their race, their ability, or many other things you could think of, their immigration status, that each time they speak up about their experience and what it's like to live as second-class citizens, they are silenced. And not just by people who are overtly hateful towards them, but people like me, people who are still trying to figure out what it would look like if we remade the world in a way that was welcoming to everybody. I think there's a fear built into that because I think about, and maybe you do too, what I would lose instead of realizing that although I think I benefit from the way things are, it will really be better for everybody if things are made more free and more just for all. The truth of every one of these scenarios, it turns out, and the truth of Peter's dilemma, the gospel truth, is that the freer others become, the freer we become too, even maybe especially when it seems the opposite, when it seems like we have something to lose. It can be hard to hold on to that truth when we know what it is to hold fast against the seemingly inexorable pull of the way we used to do things and the pleas of those who find shelter in that harbor instead of setting sail for new ways of being. As with my friend who is blowing the whistle on their family culture of abuse, when you're the one who represents a break from the behavioral patterns of the past, the entire organism or organization that you're a part of is going to do its utmost to pull you back to perceived safety or to kick you out, lest they have to seemingly upend their entire universe in response to your new way of doing things. So how do we hold fast when God is calling us to something that challenges the status quo in ways large or small? One of the most important things that we are trained to do as pastors, and one that I've shared with our Council of Deacons, is the idea of being a non-anxious presence. A non-anxious presence. It's a little bit of a mouthful, but it's a great concept. The idea is that no matter how high the stakes, you try not to get caught up in the fears and what-ifs of everybody around you. It's a crucial quality for leaders, and a leader is anyone trying to make change or take a stand in things little or big. Because even good change makes people anxious, and anxiety is contagious. You might know this, maybe from your own family or your own workplace. If you've ever voiced a new thought or approach at work or in your family or at church, and then found yourself nagged by the voices in your mind repeating others' doubts or even their imagined doubts, what you think they're thinking about this, then you know what I'm talking about. It can even be your own second guessing that pulls you away from the good. I shared a while back about volunteering to be the point person for a friend going through a mental health crisis, even though I was in a busy season of balancing work and caring for my kids in this pandemic. It was enough to make anyone wary, but I hadn't taken the decision lightly. Instead, I had sat quietly for a few moments and listened for whether I felt like this was something God wanted me to do. And as I let the noise fall away, I eventually felt that deep, peaceful yes, and so I volunteered. Yet 5 minutes later, I was questioning whether this was really a good idea. I held fast, though, by simply taking a deep breath. And every time that anxiety came up, that second guessing came up, I'd take a deep breath and remind myself who it was who had given me this assignment. And that I could leave it in those infinitely capable hands. And you know, it turned out to be a huge gift. I got to know my friend's spouse really well through this, and we shared some very beautiful conversations. And it wasn't even that much work, to tell you the truth. A lot of times those things that we're worried about end up being beautiful gifts when we can hold fast instead of succumbing to that anxiety. We've talked before about how to hear God's voice, our Mary voice, as we call it, how to go to that quiet, peaceful place where we can hear the Spirit resounding in the deepest corners of our being. For most of us, it takes practice to fine-tune our radar to hear that voice or to feeling that feeling in our gut. Whatever way you have of knowing what is right, whether it's that Mary voice or something different, I want to encourage you, once you know it, to hold fast to the truth that the Spirit has given you. to remind yourself that other people's anxiety about the situation does not have to be your anxiety. Sometimes I repeat that to myself. So-and-so's anxiety is not my anxiety. And when in doubt, I want to encourage you to repeat who it is that got you here and who will see you through, regardless of others' pressure or well-meaning concern. We're all human, of course, and while God always holds us fast, we don't always hold fast to the truths that God gives us. So if you waver or backtrack, well, first of all, as we talked about this morning with our young people, there is grace, and we get infinite more tries to do it again. But also, there may very well be a Paul to our Peter, someone who may present as a self-righteous pain in the you-know-what, yes, but who may also be a clarion call reminding us of whose we are and to whom we can cling when the sea of our truth-telling threatens to get a little stormy. Thanks be to God. Amen. I don't know if you saw the image on the front of the bulletin or at the top of the email with the order of worship, but ooh, let me see if I can share it really quickly. See if I can share the image here so that you can see. This is what happens when you're on Zoom and suddenly you realize, oh, I could just share this. Do you see? It's not that big, but do you see the two hands with the tattoos on the knuckles that say hold fast with a heart there? That tattoo and that saying, you often see it on sailors, particularly in the old days when there was tall sailing ships, but even now, sailors who go around the world, they often have hold fast tattooed to their knuckles. And it comes from a tradition that when the ship is in a storm, you're supposed to have one hand that is holding onto the ship, securing you to the ship so that you don't wash overboard. And the other hand can be free to do the work of the ship so that you, with all of your shipmates, can keep the ship alive and make it through the storm. So when we think about those, most of us probably don't have tattoos on our knuckles, but when you see that image or when you hear that phrase, hold fast, remember that in storms of anxiety, in storms of self-doubt and second-guessing and well-meaning attempts to get you to go in another direction, to steer another course, we have that one hand to hold on to the ship, to hold on to our rock, to hold on to God in those stormy seas. And the other can be used to reach out to bring others with us or to help right the ship, whatever that might be. But I encourage you as you go out into your week and out into this world to remember to hold fast to God through all the storms of our lives, whether it's standing up for what's right or whether it's just getting through another week of the pandemic. Go in peace or stay in peace for the coffee hour after the benediction response and the postlude.